Welcome to It Just So Happened. Hi, I'm Richard Pulsford, stand-up comedian and rather unprofessional historian. In this show, recorded for the It Just So Happened podcast, we will explore some of the historical people associated with and events which happened on this very day in history, which is the 8th of August. That's before we delve into some of the history of the place where today's show is taking place. So where are we? Well, it's the city which Time Out magazine last year rated the best in the world. Yes, it's Edinburgh. We are performing today as part of the Edinburgh Festival Fringe, the largest annual international arts festival in the world. And our venue this morning is the Hill Street Theatre, situated in Edinburgh's New Town. This historic A-listed building dates back to the 1820s. In 1893, it was purchased by the Masonic Lodge of Edinburgh's Mary's Chapel No. 1, so called because the lodge first met within the old chapel of St. Mary's on Nidri's Wynd in Edinburgh. It's designated No. 1 on the roll of lodges of the Grand Lodge of Scotland, as it possesses the oldest existing minute of any Masonic lodge still operating, dating back to 1599, and the first historical reference of a Freemason being initiated as a member in 1634. Making it likely to be the oldest Masonic lodge, not only in Scotland, but the world. The building has also been used as a fringe venue for the past 37 years, which then makes it the oldest fringe venue constantly in operation. Fittingly, we have an audience with us today, as the fringe welcomes audiences of up to 400,000 people each year, so we welcome about 1/100,000th of that number to this show. What's drawn in such huge numbers? Well, let me introduce today's panel. Please welcome Paul Connolly, Luis Alcada, and CJ Hooper. So, Paul Connolly is an Edinburgh-based actor and improviser, most notable for his work with TBC Improv, in Absolute Improv, and Spontaneous Players, Spontaneous Potter. It's not easy to say, actually. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your improv?
Yeah, sure. So I helped to run TBC Improv, which is an Edinburgh-based improv comedy theatre company. It's been going since 2009. And we do the Absolute Improv Show, which is the short-form style of improv, which is Whose Line style. But I also do the Spontaneous Potter Show, which is a fully improvised Harry Potter fan fiction. And I should clarify, completely unofficial as well. So it's not tied to Warner or anybody like that. Always fun to perform.
It's a good show to go and see. Apologies, Luis, I mispronounced your name at the start. Luis Alcada, is that right?
Yeah.
You're a stand-up comedian who's been on BBC Social, and you run the Icebreaker Comedy Nights in Dundee.
Yes, the
Icebreaker is Dundee's best/only comedy club. Just down the road, I started putting on gigs about 5 years ago, and there was barely anything else happening in Dundee, so it just took off. And yeah. If you're ever in Dundee, you should pop along.
Thank you. And CJ Hooper, you're a comedian and historian, improvising poetry because you're too lazy to write a script, so you tell me. Mm-hmm. And you are once an archaeologist, now a performer, as your career is now in ruins. That's his joke, not mine.
As a historian, all my jokes are very old. Yep, I'm an improvising sort of poet comedian, and as some of you will have already observed, I am also a little bit deaf. Now, as this is going to be a podcast, please clap as well as the sign language applause, which is jazz hands for the purpose of the tape.
Yes. Tape, yeah, we've moved on from tape. Yeah. Showing your age there.
I used to be a private investigator as well. So.
Oh, yeah, you're right, sorry. Straight over to you, Paul, now, for your on the stage, please. Thank you.
Sorry, I just like the idea. I used to be a private investigator, so I would say to the criminals, can you just speak into the tape?
Yeah.
I'm just secretly recording you on.
Things going
on. That's how long ago it was.
So today is the 8th of August, and on this day in 1963, the Kingsmen, the American band, released their version of Louie Louie, which would have an FBI investigation as to determine whether it was obscene or not. So we rewind the clock a little bit back to 1953, and when Richard Berry, an American musician, writes the song Louie Louie, and with his band The Pharaohs, they release it. Now the song itself is a fairly innocuous, it's an awesome song. If you're not familiar with it, you know, you should definitely listen to it. But it's a fairly innocuous song about a gentleman who is missing his love, who's over the ocean. He's singing about how much he's looking forward to getting back over and seeing said love. They released the song in 1953, and it does fairly well. 1959, Richard, needing to pay for his wedding, sells the rights to the song. So he sells the rights for $750. And unfortunately, at that time as well, being a black artist, often they were not treated well in terms of the business side of things when it came to music rights. And if you look at Little Richard and what happened with him, it was some really rubbish stuff. But he sold his rights, that was it. Fast forward to 1963, the Kingsmen want to work on a cruise ship, and so go into the studio to record as their audition a version of Louie Louie. So they go in and they record, and they do two takes of the song, and the version that they record, they've got a producer in, and he wants everything to be loud. He wants everything to be, the vocals not just to be loud, but the audio and the music and all this stuff. So he puts it all loud, and it's almost incomprehensible what's being sung in the song. But they record it, they've got this as an audition piece, they try to get the job on the cruise ship, they fail to get that. However, it gets released as a single, gets to number two, it's a huge hit for them. I mean, it basically launches them. But because his lyrics aren't quite clear what he's actually singing, and it's not clear if he's singing the original lyrics or if he's changing it to be something else, everybody starts to wonder what was actually written there. So kids on the playground are coming up with their own ideas as to what these lyrics might be, and then parents are seeing what their kids think the lyrics are. Then they're trying to listen to it, and they're thinking to themselves, oh, it must be something really obscene or horrendous, and it gets blown out of proportion. I mean, this is before Twitter or anything like that, but you could just imagine what that would be like today, people having their suspicious theories as to what horrendous lyrics. Get so bad that a lot of these parents start writing letters to Congress and to FBI, and the lyrics, they're so obscene, I can't even share with you the lyrics, they're that obscene. Nobody knows what the lyrics actually are. Nobody's actually listening to the record. So, and it goes, the Attorney General at the time, Robert F. Kennedy, is getting involved in this. J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI, is getting involved. And eventually the FBI go, okay, fine, we're going to open an investigation, we're going to investigate this record, the Kingsman's version. And they're trying to see if it's been obscene materials being transported across state lines. So that's, you know, and it's quite a serious offence at the time. So they spend 2 years, they investigate, they play the record at different speeds, they get the original lyrics from the writer, and then they're trying to see if the lyrics got changed over at some point. They're trying to investigate whether it was an intentionally making it ambiguous so that you could hide obscenity by ambiguity. And it's so much insanity. 2 years goes by, and eventually they go, okay, we can't find something. We don't know if there's actually something here. If you're curious as to seeing the 119-page report that was written up on it, you can actually go on the, genuinely, you can go on the FBI's website and their vaults, and you can read for yourself the original report that got written on it. But eventually there's this 2 years go by, and nothing's found on it. Ironically enough, of course, as many people might know, if you listen to the Kingsman's version of it, which is the version you hear in Animal House and lots of other places, at the 54-second mark, you can clearly hear the drummer, Dick Peterson, drop an F-bomb, because he drops his drumstick. The FBI didn't pick up on that, because they were too busy looking at the lyrics. So, to bring the story back a little bit, so Richard Berry, the guy who wrote it, this song has been recorded 1,000 times over the years, but you get to the mid-80s and Richard Berry, he's living on welfare. He's living with his mother and kind of struggling a bit financially. There's a company called California Cooler, I may have got that slightly off, but it's a drink company, and they want to use the song in a commercial campaign, but they need to get the rights from the original lyricist. So they get lawyers out to visit so that they can get the rights, and the lawyer visits, and they're chatting, and the lawyer says, well, you know what, you can actually get the rights back to your song just because of how things have changed. This is the 80s, a few decades on. So Richard, he goes back to the record label who owns it, and they eventually settle out of court, and Richard ends up with millions of dollars. So there's a kind of a happy ending. He passes away in 1987, but he does get some of the money from the song that he created, and that has brought joy to a lot of people. But yes, that got released on this day in 1963.
That's lovely, thank you. Thank you. I had images of the coffin being lowered and it accidentally drops and everyone going, oh, fuck. That'd be amusing. I'm going to do a couple of segue pieces in between the panellists, so this is my first one. So the question, when was the first documented balloon flight in Europe?
Ooh, is this something where it's like 1870, I'm going to see, or does that feel to
1865?
I think it is 1833. Oh gosh, right. It was actually on this day in 1709.
What? 1709?
Oh, wow. Now, the Montgolfier brothers may have demonstrated their first hot air balloon in France in 1783, which is, I thought, the answer you might have gone for. But this predates that by 74 years. So I'm going to completely mash up the Portuguese language here. But so it's something like Bartolomeu de Gusmão.
Guzmán.
Right, so it's him. He was a Brazilian Portuguese priest. I'll just call him Bart from now on,
yeah,
if that's all right. The 24-year-old managed to lift a small balloon made of paper full of hot air about 4 metres by setting fire to fuel within an earthenware container slung below the balloon. It worked perfectly. It went up in the air, the flame went out, and it came down. Who witnessed his demonstration? Because we didn't know
about
it, did we?
Did he witness it, or was he looking in the wrong direction at the time?
It would have been a shame, wouldn't it?
Oh, I managed to finally do it.
Just put that in the fire.
Anyone important?
So where was this again, sir?
So it happened on the patio of the House of India in Lisbon.
Yeah, was it a sister who saw it? I learned about this in Portugal, but it was a while ago.
Well, it happened in front of King John V and the Portuguese court, so some very important people saw this happen. And it was his third attempt. So what do you think might have gone wrong with the first two attempts?
Oh, fireballs. There must be massive fireballs. The king's like, are you trying to attack me or impress me?
Well, I thought these might have been like the Chinese lanterns. They might have been hit by an owl or something.
Yeah, he nearly set the palace alight. And he also burned two of the cassocks he was wearing. So if you're going to be doing this sort of thing, don't wear a cassock. So what do you think the king made of this demonstration, successful one, of the balloon?
Stuff.
Yeah.
Hey.
He invented flight and pyrotechnics at the same time.
Pyrotechnics?
He invented flight and pyrotechnics shows
at the
same time.
Pioneering.
I assume he just went, how can I use this to get more power?
Well, the king was very impressed. So he made Barty a cannon. the cassock's type of cannon, I can see where this is going. And granted him the right of any and all flying ships from then on. And for all those who dared to intervene or to copy his ideas, the penalty would be death. So he had quite a good patent there.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Barty wanted to build a machine to fly people. So his design was a balloon in the form of a bird with a tail and wings and a boat underneath. The invention was called Passarola, which means big bird, is that right? Yeah. It was filled with numerous tubes through which the wind would flow and fill out the bulges to give it shape. It is said that he attempted to lift himself from St. George Castle in Lisbon and landed about 1 kilometre away, but unfortunately the claim cannot be verified. So do you think that was true? Was it true?
I think St. George's Castle is at the very top of this massive hill. You pretty much just have to let yourself go to be a mile away.
And cross your fingers.
Did he survive the attempt?
Yes.
Well, I suppose he lived to tell the tale.
He told the tale, but that can't sort of prove it.
I'm pretty sure I could do better than that with just the blankets or an umbrella.
Did nobody see the travelling this kilometre, or did he do it at night time?
I don't know, but it says that it can't be verified, so unfortunately the right people didn't see it.
Well, I realise I'm painting myself as the cynical one in the corner at this point.
You don't have to be.
Well, it raises the question, did the Chinese not have something earlier than this?
Well, you've got the Chinese lantern.
I might come to this.
Sorry.
So, given Barty's successful invention and his the fact that the king was impressed, what do you think happened to him after King John V actually died? Was it still a success story?
Yeah. Didn't he get in trouble with the church after? I should clarify, there's a whole book of fiction about this that you're forced to read in high school, and I'm now getting mixed up between the fiction and the actual historical facts.
Well, the commoners didn't trust this guy, Barty, So they reported him to the Portuguese Inquisition as a wizard.
No one expected that.
No, I didn't expect the Portuguese Inquisition. Barty, who was terrified of the Inquisition, took the advice of his friends, burned his manuscripts, disguised himself, and fled to Spain, where he died in the hospital. And I think that kind of explains why we've not really heard of him. Now, there is indirect evidence that the Chinese solved the problem of aerial navigation using balloons hundreds of years before the 18th century. Mongolian army studied Kongming lanterns from China and used them in the Battle of Legnica in 1241 during the Mongol invasion of Poland. So this is the first time ballooning was known in the Western world, mm-hmm. So to be fair. Over to you, Lewis, now for your piece.
And that actually links in really nice, because my story is also about someone getting in trouble with the church. And this is exactly 100 years before. In 1609, the Catholic Church was examining Galileo Galilei's telescope, which I'm pretty sure is against something in Leviticus, examining another man's telescope. But as we all know, Galileo was a very famous scientist of his time. He invented the telescope. He spent a lot of time looking up at the sky and cataloging a lot of things, discovered the rings in Saturn, and the main thing that he got in trouble for was for the heliocentric. I like how he got in trouble for being an astrologist, for an astronomer, and it's that getting me stuck, for being an astronomer. You know, astronomer always leads to crime, and this time in the 1600s. He was a big defender of the heliocentric movement. He said he observed that Venus had seasons, therefore the sun is in the center. Spoiler alert, the sun is actually in the center of the solar system and everything else goes around it. The church was not a big fan because it obviously goes against when Jesus said, this is the greatest commandment, do not look up at the skies and try to map the planets.
That was the 11th one before.
Yeah, that's in the extended version.
Deleted scenes from the Ten Commandments.
Yeah. There's a few very obscure verses that imply that the earth is still and the sun goes around it. So the church did not like anyone contesting that. Common misconception, he wasn't actually the first person to defend the heliocentric movement. It's always had quite a big cult following over the years. There's always been one person who was like, the earth's moving! But the church's approach at the time was that you could believe the heliocentric movement as long as you pretended you didn't. From when he first got in trouble with the Inquisition and spoke to the Pope, and the Pope said, you can do whatever you want, as long as you have a disclaimer at the beginning saying, this is fiction. I don't actually believe any of this. It was like, you know how racist people these days can say, I'm not a racist, but. In those days, you had to say, I'm not a heliocentrist, but this is how the universe works. And a little side note, heliocentrism was the main thing he got in trouble for, but he got in trouble for pretty much everything he did. Like, there was people who contested that there were mountains on the moon. These were people who actually went to university. And like, you can see them, they're right there, but they hated the idea of mountains on the moon. He managed to get away with heliocentrism for quite a long time, and the church kind of let it go. What actually got him in massive trouble, which is, you know, I'm not defending the church in any way, but you can kind of see where they were coming from on this one. He wrote a play where, basically defending heliocentrism, and there was a character who was heliocentric and explained how the universe worked, and there was a character called Simplicius, who was a complete idiot and just argued against him with just really terrible arguments the whole time. The Pope at the time read this, Pope Urban VIII, and he went, okay, you can publish this play, but I want my arguments to be in this. And Galileo said, fair enough, I'll add your arguments. And then added the Pope's arguments as said by Simplicius the idiot. Which you can see is a kind of a, it's not a nice move. It's like if I asked Richard to be on the podcast and Richard just got a puppet called the Portuguese arsehole to say all my lines. Like, you can see why the Pope was upset. And little side note, like the popes at this time were the coolest. They were like the top of the social hierarchy. They were like the rappers of their time. Like if you've ever been to the Vatican Museum, we went there because my wife thought it was gonna, my wife's quite Catholic, she thought it was gonna be a really spiritual experience. If you've been to the Vatican Museum,
yeah,
it's actually, most of the paintings are just old popes with just loads of jewelry and a woman on each side. A woman just wearing a small dress, and there's just a little thing underneath going, the women represent virtue and honesty or something. But like, I find the journey fascinating, how like the alpha male iconography hasn't changed in the last 400 years. But anyway, Urban VIII, again, sounds so much like a rapper, was really upset about this. He was in trouble in the Inquisition for the second time. And this time, again, common misconception, people think that he was imprisoned or tortured. He was actually just confined to house arrest for the rest of his days, which, you know, he got to live in a house in Tuscany for the rest of his days. As punishment goes, it's actually a pretty light one by church standards. He mostly got away with it.
Aye, he was lucky.
Yeah. Church punishment standards, he was basically fine. He was... final note, there's a happy ending to this. He did eventually get pardoned by the church. The church recanted condemning him in 1992, like John Paul II, over almost 400 years later, went, fine, we maybe shouldn't have condemned someone just for explaining how the solar system works. So, yeah, he got his comeuppance 400 years later. Good on him.
Thank you. So it was on this day in 1966 that the South African Broadcasting Corporation banned all Beatles records. Mm-hmm. Why?
Well, because they were bigger than Jesus.
Mm, yeah, yeah, exactly, yeah.
Well, was he a Stones kind of guy, you know?
Do you want to tell us a little bit of the background to that, rather than me talking about it?
Well,
it sounds like you know about it.
The part, yeah, I know was that, John Lennon, as far as I'm aware, he kind of was atheist, so it wasn't necessarily that he was... But he was trying to explain about the influence of the church in the society was going down, and it was a natural thing, and that to a lot of kids today, the Beatles were more important to them,
mm-hmm,
than Jesus was.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just sort of stating a fact that,
yeah,
that for a lot of kids, but it gets picked up, and then everybody's like, oh, this is what he believes. And
yeah, yeah. So a deliberate misinterpretation, because,
yeah,
it had been published in some publication, and no one,
yeah,
thought anything of it.
Yeah.
But then someone picked that up and made a big story out to say, oh, they're claiming,
yeah,
that
like
they're bigger than Jesus, that like they're sort of more important, that they're better than Jesus, and that's not,
yeah,
really what they were on about.
Because was it like an American DJ or something, like in a small town, just like picks it up,
yeah,
and is just like, oh, I've just found this thing, now let's burn their records.
It's always in America, isn't it? I don't know.
Always in America.
Any Americans.
I heard the Terry Pratchett spin on that, if I may reference,
yeah,
Sir Terry, rest him,
mm-hmm,
which was in the sort of the pseudo-Dutch country with the band that mimicking Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
They said, well, over here, you know, you're very popular. You're almost popular than one of our main exports. And he said, we're more popular than cheeses. That's the level we're going for next.
Yeah.
So just be ready.
Even I wasn't tuned into that pun at first. Also, on this day, though, in 1969, the Beatles posed for an outdoor photo session at NW89AY. Where was this?
It's Abbey Road, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we all know that one. We know that one.
So it's the zebra crossing in Abbey Road, London, for the cover of the Beatles' last studio recorded album, Abbey Road. It took place on the zebra crossing outside the studio. How many shots did photographer Ian McMillan take for that shoot?
Is there something like... There's definitely multiple, because I've seen the various shots and they've gone backwards and forwards.
I was going to go for the question of one, but that'll teach me.
No,
so.
I think it was over 100.
I thought it was like 4 or 5 or something, but like...
Was it zero?
It was actually a drawing. It's just really well done.
It was 6, so you're very close.
Okay.
Yeah. He stood on a stepladder in the middle of the road while a policeman stopped the traffic. After they'd finished being photographed, they decided it was much too early to start recording. So Ringo went shopping. Paul took John back to his home for a cup of tea, and George went to visit Regent's Park Zoo.
Rock and roll.
Yes.
It was a strong
a bit like a bit rock and roll, like being comedians. Yeah? What made this particular Beatles album cover unique compared to all their previous ones? A bit of a niche question there.
So I can think of two things. I don't know if it's related to that. One is that I think it's Paul doesn't have shoes on.
Yes, that's that. Yes, I'll come to that.
Oh no, I was going ahead. Oh no, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Did it have no text on it?
Well, no, because the White Album.
Oh, the White Album,
in.
Of course. Yeah.
It features at least one Beatle in double denim, which I very much approve of.
I didn't mention this at the start, did I? So I'll put you out of your misery. So this was the one and only time that the Beatles had an album cover that didn't feature their name or the title of the LP. At all. But then you're saying about the White Album.
Well,
right?
Isn't the White Album famously, it's just a white, it's not actually called White, it's just a white.
I can't guarantee that everything I say is 100% true because I got this off the internet.
It's got the Beatles doing white on white.
Can we put this to the referees there? Was I right?
Right or
right?
Right.
Right
or right.
It's not that sort of thing. So sorry, audience.
Well, I don't know, let's move on from that. I think we're going to start a new controversy. Don't tell the Americans.
Okay.
Right. What was on the back cover of the album?
The song listings.
Draft list, yeah.
It wasn't what I was looking for. They may be.
A barcode.
Was it the empty zebra crossing?
So there was a street sign with the name Abbey Road NW8. And that was taken at the other end of the street from the zebra crossing.
So I just assumed NW8 was a precursor to another rap group, possibly with a Pope in it.
Yeah. And then they got together and it's Urbanate and NW8.
Urbanate.
Yeah. One of the first ideas for the name of the album was to call it Everest. Any ideas why?
Because it was such a mountain of a task to get it done.
Yeah.
Was the zebra crossing went uphill?
Because they were at the peak of their powers now. It was the name of the brand of cigarettes that engineer George Emmerich smoked during the sessions.
Mm-hmm.
Just 12 days later, saw the last time all four Beatles members recorded in the studio together. And exactly 2 weeks later, they had one last photo shoot together at John's house in Ascot. One of the pictures was later used on the cover of the Hey Jude compilation LP. Now, on the 22nd of May 2012, one of the outtakes from the photography session was sold at the auction in London, and how much do you think it fetched?
Ooh, at least £12.50.
It was at least £12.50. Yeah.
It's reduced.
Oh, okay, £13.
Yes.
It was a lot back then. Yeah. It's worth at least 5 million these days.
Yeah. Do you want to guess?
Oh, I'm going to say £200, because that is a lot of money back then.
Well,
oh, no, I think it's 2012.
Oh, sorry.
How would you get it wrong?
Inflation's
bad.
It's bad for the last 10 years.
So we're in decimal in the whole thing.
Yeah.
3 shillings and 6 pence.
It was,
I'm going to say 125,000.
Well, 16,000. So, yeah, still a fair amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Paul McCartney took his sandals off for the shoot.
Mm-hmm.
Why has this been seen as a clue to a conspiracy theory?
So, I want to say the proper answer, but
I'm
not sure.
No, go ahead.
Because the real Paul McCartney had a wooden leg.
Yes.
Well, because I mean, most people know about the theory that Paul is dead, that he died in a car accident, and that he was replaced. And so, traditionally, at a wake, when you put the body out, you don't have shoes on them, and shoes on the table is bad luck and all this kind of stuff. So, by him not having shoes on that, it was seen as a sign that the Beatles are saying he's dead, because I think. There's another one thing as well, which I don't know if... Because the cigarette that one of them's holding got airbrushed out in more recent...
Yeah.
There's one of them's holding the cigarette on the cover, and then there's a huge controversy because a few years back, they airbrushed out the cigarette when they did really...
Which would have been an Everest cigarette, presumably.
Presumably would have been Everest.
Mm-hmm. The police van on the cover is usually seen at traffic fatalities, and the four Beatles represent a funeral procession. So George is the gravedigger, Paul is the corpse, Ringo is the congregation, and John is the priest. McCartney himself parodied all of it in the title and album artwork for his 1993 concert album, Paul is Alive. And if anyone's into The National, The National have a song called Paul is Alive, but that's by the by. Over to you, CJ. I've talked too long. Please, for your topic.
Right, well, yeah. Thank you very much. Well, I'm going to talk a bit of a segue from the previous one, because tell me if I'm wrong, but when Galileo had to say this is fiction,
yes.
And he goes through his spiel, mm-hmm. is this is all fiction, but the Earth moves. Is that correct?
That's actually an urban legend. He never
Urban the Eighth Legend.
Urban the Eighth Legend. The Pope said it. No, there's a story that just as he was dying, his last words, but the Earth moves, which is not actually
it's
true.
Not
his last words
true.
Are probably, ow, that hurts.
Well, in the tradition of oblique segues, one time that the Earth did move was on this day in 1303 with the Great Cretan Earthquake, which is something of its misnomer, because they shouldn't have been taken by surprise by this, because the area is known for sort of tectonic displacement and things like this, because there had been an earlier earthquake, which was around about 1100 BC. And what happened there was another earthquake just north of Crete at the island, well, actually a volcano at the island of Santorini, which means that Santorini has been left as a great volcanic caldera, a great sort of curving sort of crescent U-shape where the middle was blown out, which gave reference and point to some people thinking that Santorini, and in particular the city of Akrotiri Thera that was there, for actually being Atlantis. That was one of those theories. And people often said it couldn't possibly be Atlantis, because as Atlantis is beyond the Pillars of Hercules, which is always, Plato said this, and it was always rumoured to be, Pillars of Hercules is the way into the Mediterranean Sea. So beyond the Pillars of Hercules is that way, therefore the Atlantis. Of course, people have ignored the fact that you can go two ways past gates. So it could have actually been Akrotiri Thera. And actually, if I may segue into conspiracy theories a little bit, I first went to Santorini as an archaeology student when I was about 19. And I was just discovering the works of H.P. Lovecraft. Does anybody else here know these works?
Yeah.
Yeah, so getting nods. Any nods in the audience? So we've got some, great, got some nerds in. You're my people. they have tales here of great old things and old gods, in particular the squid-headed god, or elder one of Great Cthulhu. And I'm reading these stories for perhaps the first time, and then going round the remains, or the archaeology dig, of Akrotiri Thera, and there are cave paintings revering squids and things like that, and including a painting of a squid-headed man. Akrotiri Thera wasn't excavated until 1956, and yet these stories were being written in the 1920s. Coincidence, people? Coincidence? But I'm segueing away from this particular date. So, with the Great Cretan Earthquake, it was huge and it was massive, and the repercussions were seen far and wide and quite a long way away. It partially ruined the lighthouse of Alexandria in Egypt, which was one of the Seven Wonders, so it sort of partially destroyed that as well. And actually, in Egypt itself, the tsunamis were so big that boats were found 5 miles inland in Egypt. That's where they landed. Now, if we want to be back into conspiracy theories, you could take this wonderful idea, therefore, that maybe Egypt wasn't always deserts, which is why those ships got as far inland as they did. Or perhaps it was a bit like Arrakis, you know, the planet Dune, and great sea and rains one day arose and then went away again. That's another one for the Uberners. I just quite like the theory that on that day, in 1303, the Egyptians invented surfing. And if we're going to applaud that one, in the traditional way, we can either applaud or laugh, or a bit like the Greeks, give it a big wave. Now. Also, quickly before we finish up with that, was that a groan at the back?
Yes, it was. Yeah.
For the benefit of the tape, that we have head in hand at the back of the audience. So what we see, Egypt sort of bore on the brunt of it reached as far as Italy as well. Greece, bizarrely, and Crete, there was some damage, obviously, because there was this massive, huge earthquake, reportedly about what would have been 12 on the Richter scale or something like that. So we're talking sort of quite huge. But the main brunt was the tsunamis and things that followed. Why was this not such a problem for places like Athens and Naplio and Corinth? Water doesn't mix with Greece.
Oh.
Oh. And on that bombshell, I'll hand back to you, Richard.
I've just realised what my audiences feel like. Okay, time has rapidly escaping, so we must come on to the second half of the show where we uncover some of the history of Edinburgh. Now, slight disclaimer here, Paul has been on the previous show, so you've already heard some of the questions, so this is testing your memory, some of this. But the first thing I'm going to talk about is Edinburgh's hills. Now, many cities in the world claim to be built on seven hills. It's quite an exhaustive list. This does include Edinburgh. Can you name any of the other cities in the world which are built on seven
Rome.
Hills? Rome is a good one.
Yep. Lisbon.
Lisbon is a good one.
Norwich.
Not such a good one.
I should know the answers because I told them the other day.
Well, let me just list some. So Jerusalem, Athens, Tehran, Prague, Kyiv, interestingly. And in America, we've got San Francisco.
Of course.
Washington, D.C. And in Ohio, something called Seven Hills.
Clues
in there. So, see if you can remember the seven hills that Edinburgh is built on.
Okay.
Right.
Right. So I'll try and go in alphabetical order as best I can. So
alphabetical order, even more impressive.
Arthur C.
Yes.
Braids Hill.
Not alphabetical order, but yeah.
Oh, there's another one beginning with A.
No, B.
B. Oh, no. Oh, I've already messed up. Blafford Hill. Blafford Hill is wonderful. If you've not been there, you should definitely go there. Blafford Hill. Okay, slightly out of order now, but Castle Rock.
No, slightly out of order.
Carlton Hill.
Yes.
Carlton Hill. Craig Walker.
Slightly out of order. You just said it, didn't you?
Did I? Castle Rock, yeah.
And
Craig Walker. The Collington.
No, hang on. No, before Craig Walker is...
Collington? Corstorphin. Corstorphin Hill.
Way, we got there.
Seamless.
That didn't deserve applause.
I often get that.
We'll fix the impost, yeah.
Arthur's Seat is a hill just to the east of Edinburgh city centre, 822 feet above sea level, which is in fact an ancient volcanic plug, to go back to volcanoes. The lava has been dated to about 340 million years old. Now, how did Arthur's Seat get its name?
Because Arthur sat there.
Who was he?
It was the only place King Arthur could get accommodation during the Fringe.
is it Conan Doyle rather than... Arthur Conan Doyle, sitting up there seeking inspiration?
Yeah.
Well, Arthur Doyle, as he might have been called at the time, the Conan was a later edition, I believe.
Okay. Yeah. So, King Arthur's Fringe show was called Grails, Grails, Grails. It's a cabaret show.
that was covered by the crew later on. Yeah.
It took me a while. I'm not tuned into puns today for some reason. This is not a good sign. Any ideas? Can you remember?
I'll be honest, I'm getting distracted trying to think, what was the actual correct answer I got the other day?
Well, to be fair, there is no correct answer. There are lots of legends around, say, for example, King Arthur or other Arthurs, and then there's a kind of an 18th century historian called William Maitland who proposed something based on a Gaelic name, which translates as height of arrows. I don't think that really informs us very much. So can you tell us how the nearby cliffs known as Salisbury Crags formed?
Now that one I kind of, because it's the sediment from the ice age, so the ice that came down and cut into the rock and all that kind of stuff, it basically exposed the rock as it's come by, and then when that all melts because the planet warmed up, which that's not going to happen again. Oh no. It left behind all the scratching of the rock. Salisbury Crag is a really cool area, and it's a good one to, it's easy to get up, relatively speaking.
Yeah, if it's not closed, is it not closed?
Well, you can still get up if you kind of a little bit more from the Oliver Park side.
Yeah, right.
So you've got all the strata and everything going there.
Yeah.
How long ago was that? I mean, we're into the millions, I think, but yeah.
The glacier was in the past 2 million years, so relatively recent, geologically speaking. Talking of which, so how did the local geology inform the so-called father of modern geology, James Hutton?
Email?
No, is a short answer.
He looked at the rocks. I remember it from the other day now. He looked at it and he realised that it meant the world had to be older than 6,000 years because of the Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So there's a small...
Take that, Urban VIII.
A small area of Salisbury Crags known as Hutton's Section, where he observed that the magma had forced its way through the sedimentary rocks. And due to thanks to observations such as this, realised that he could develop the theory that geological features are not static but undergo continuing transformation over extremely long periods of time, and therefore the Earth is not as young as the church was saying at the time, or many in the church were saying. How is Edinburgh's disgrace? What's the official name for it?
Could you know? Rowling.
Oh, right. Now we won't get to Edinburgh. Let's keep it light. Can you remember the official title for it?
It was commemorating Napoleonic.
Yeah, so we're talking about the half-finished monument on Calton Hill. Its official name is the National Monument to the Fallen of the Napoleonic Wars, but it's also known as Edinburgh's Disgrace. And so why is it considered a disgrace?
Because didn't they get finished?
Yeah, it's not finished, yeah.
But honestly, we've got a lot more to be disgraced about in Edinburgh, to be honest. It's very middle class of us to be like, we didn't finish that Athenian temple we were planning. Oh, what a disgrace.
So why did they, back in the 1820s, think it was a cool idea to have the model of the Parthenon in Edinburgh?
Again, I know the answer.
I was looking at the archaeologist guy, but all you're doing is twiddling with your moustache, but not saying anything. So, no idea.
Well, I'm having to do something to do with universities and a seat of learning, I was probably thinking.
Kind of, in a way. So it was during the period known as the Enlightenment, the 1820s, and Edinburgh was known as the Athens of the North. So this guy, William Playfair, thought, oh, great idea if we model something based on the Parthenon as our monument to the Napoleonic Wars. And one of the leading men in that campaign was someone called Thomas Bruce, 7th Earl of Elgin. Do we know about him?
Lost his marble. No, he got his marbles.
He stole the marbles, shall we say. Yeah. Yeah, so interesting. He did have these connections with Greece, shall we say.
Yeah, never played marbles in Athens. Yeah.
Mm. £42,000 was required to be raised by public subscription, so Parliament was going to put some money towards it, but not everything. Construction went ahead in 1826, but only one third of the amount was raised, so building work was abandoned in 1829 with just the base and 12 columns complete, and that's what you can see on Calton Hill. So over the years, people have thought, well, we've got this half-finished monument, maybe we could make something of it, we could commemorate something, or any ideas, what ideas have come forward over the years for?
I think a prison.
Ooh.
Now hear me out, because you've got 12 bars already.
Yeah.
So all you need to do is just tell them to go inside and get them to face that direction. So you're behind bars and just hope they don't turn around.
Yeah. Interesting.
Well, with 12 bars, I thought they possibly could have made it the drinking quarter, but then they looked out across the rest of
something musical.
It must be a fringe venue at some point.
Yeah. Well,
if you get a Beltane Fire Festival happens on there, that's actually quite impressive. The Big Five, you're here on April 30th, you see them doing all that stuff, the body paint and all. Fire and doing some wonderful physicality, and I realise the tape's not picking it up.
It's still running. It is still running. Yeah, normally
that's
stop.
Where Bartolomeu Guzmán goes to show his latest inventions. That's where the Portuguese priest who sets himself on fire goes and does his latest show every year.
You see this balloon and two burning castles.
Yes. Yeah. Isn't where they have the famous Urbanate festival every year?
Right, so back to the monument.
Back to the question of something silly.
I couldn't do that without sounding really horrible. Sorry. I must learn some etiquette. Yeah, so over the years, they have thought about a monument to Queen Victoria when she died in 1901, something commemorating the second to the 200th anniversary of the 1707 Act of Union with England. Don't know why that wasn't popular. A new Scottish National Gallery in 1907, a Scottish Parliament building in 1908, and a memorial to those who fell in the Great War in 1918. So, none of that happened. And how did Glasgow Council offer to help?
By moving it to Glasgow?
might have been easier. Yeah.
They did offer to pay for the rest of it, didn't they? Yeah.
But what was the proviso if they finished it? If Glasgow could finish it, what had to happen?
It was a quid pro quo, wasn't there? It was Edinburgh had to do something for Glasgow, wasn't it?
They had a massive party there.
Well, Glasgow, it was fairly simple. They just said, we want our insignia on your Edinburgh monument. That's what Glasgow said.
And yeah, man.
For some reason, Edinburgh declined. And
harsh.
Hence one of its other names, the Pride and the Poverty. And does anyone... Oh,
sorry, they should have offered to finish the monument, but they have to put a traffic cone on top to make it Glaswegian.
Or one for each column or something. Does anyone know, either panel or audience, in fact, where a full-scale replica of the Parthenon was actually successfully completed in 1897? You either know it or you don't know it.
This is going to be kicking myself on.
Is it? Right. So it's in the US. Does that help?
It's Washington, isn't it?
No, I'm sorry. No, it's in Nashville to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the state of Tennessee. So it is possible to build and complete on these monuments if you know what you're doing. Mm-hmm. Right. Very long question here, so please concentrate. What happened in 1916 which made the Keeper of the Great Seal of Scotland move the regalia of Scotland from the Crown Room in Edinburgh Castle to one of the castle vaults in 1916? So we'll give these two guys a chance because you can remember this.
Did someone try to steal it?
Nope.
So we're in the Great War then.
Yeah.
So, and I'm thinking, and I'm trying not to be silent for the purpose of the podcast, I'm thinking we've got not necessarily theft, but some sort of mutiny or rebellion occurring at the time, because certainly I know within Ireland and sort of areas of anti-English sentiment, there was rising up, not necessarily on the side of the Germans, but certainly on against sort of what's perceived to be the English side of things. Mm. So I'm guessing it's a rebellion, and the building was stormed or attacked or similar?
I'd like your answer, but it's not right.
Oh.
So it was after German air raids on the city, in which one bomb exploded near the castle, and it was decided that the roof of the Crown Room was not bomb-proof, so the regalia were moved for their safety. But what was unusual at the time about these air raids?
Zeppelins?
Yes, indeed. So for about half an hour on the night of the 2nd to 3rd of April 1916, two German airships, the L-14 and the L-22, dropped 7 incendiary and 17 high-explosive bombs on Leith and the city of Edinburgh. 13 people died and 24 were injured. The White Hart Hotel in the Grassmarket and the County Hotel in Lothian Road suffered substantial damage, as well as a number of tenement buildings in Newington. A flagstone in the Grassmarket marks the spot where a bomb landed in front of the White Hart Inn, making a 9 by 6 foot crater. Talking of the White Hart Inn, parts of that building date back to 1516, which makes it the oldest pub in Edinburgh city centre. I got corrected by this yesterday. And also claims to be the most haunted. Mm-hmm. Do you think it is? Do you know any others? I mean, how do you prove this sort of thing, really?
Yeah. Not without Yvette Fielding, certainly.
need an expert in, don't we?
just go around and see how haunted the people look.
Yeah, well, which during the Fringe is quite... a few comedians have started to look haunted already. Yeah, I mean, the Banshee Labyrinth also claims to be the most haunted, I believe, which is in... Yeah. Which street is it in?
That's Nidger Street,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there are no doubt others as well.
Well, I think that the Banshee Labyrinth, because it's the Fringe in particular, I myself have died on stage there. my comedy ghost still haunts that room.
Hard to believe, CJ. In 1803, William and Dorothy Wordsworth stayed at the White Hart Inn while on their tour of Scotland. Now, bear in mind that this is in the Grassmarket. How do you think Dorothy Wordsworth described the pub in a kind of early version of TripAdvisor?
Indelicately.
Food arrived cold, 1 star.
She said it was not noisy and tolerably cheap.
Nice.
So how the Grassmarket has changed, I would suggest.
Would recommend.
Yes. Yeah. Right, new subject. Who was Greyfriars Bobby?
Well, I know the answer.
Yes.
But I prefer the alternative answer, that Greyfriars Bobby would be busy chasing around Greyfriars Churchyard or Kirkyard for resurrectionists and body snatchers. He was there for Greyfriars Bobby the policeman.
And
that's not the real answer. I think
So what is the correct answer then?
Is it Doug? He's a dog.
Yes.
We does.
And what kind of dog or dog?
A Scotty dog?
Terrier?
Yes.
Jack Russell?
See, you have to be very careful here. So he was a Skye Terrier dog.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. He was born on the 4th of May 1855 and became known for spending 14 years guarding the grave of his owner in the kirkyard until the dog himself died in January 1872. Bobby's headstone was placed by the Dog Aid Society at the kirkyard's entrance in 1981. What spot does this mark?
I always assumed it was where the grave was.
Mm. Well, this is what most tourists seem to think, that must be the case, but actually no one knows where he's buried. It's actually unmarked, the grave, so that's just an assumption.
He has a very shiny nose, I believe.
He does, yes, on the statue that I'll be coming to in a moment. Who owned Bobby?
The people.
The people.
The people owned Bobby.
In the Socialist Republic.
Indeed. Get that red flag up. Bobby, here you go, lad.
Slightly before the Clydes.
I personally welcome our four-legged dictator.
So there are two contradictory contemporary accounts. Both name someone called John Gray. One has him as a night watchman, another as a farmer. Now, it's not uncommon in 19th century Europe. In fact, there are over 60 documented accounts of graveyard or cemetery stray dogs that were fed by visitors or curators, to the point that the dogs just hung around, and then people thought, oh, well, they must be guarding someone's grave. This happened also in the kirkyard at Greyfriars, when an article appeared in the Scotsman and people started looking out for this dog. And then Edinburgh people thought, a way to make money here.
Mm-hmm.
And this might explain Bobby's supposed longevity, because one author is quite forthright in saying that obviously the dog couldn't have lived that long, so they just replaced the dog when it died, because they just wanted to keep making money from this project.
This might be...
I definitely had a goldfish that lived that long when I was a child.
Yes, yes.
It was chameleon goldfish, because it would change colour as well.
This might be quite cynical, but if you're a dog, a graveyard's a great place to hang out. You're literally surrounded by bones everywhere.
Mm.
It's probably just a bunch of dogs who are like, this is the place to be.
I think,
bones.
I think they normally try and hide the bones, admittedly, in the graveyard.
Not
about
normally.
6 feet.
I've heard that, you know, so they have the dog by the headstone and would howl away through the day and through all the night. I heard it was because they put the headstone down on his tail.
I
wonder he didn't move, poor thing.
Oh,
justice for Bobby.
Yes. So the 1912 novel Greyfriars Bobby by the American author Eleanor Atkinson popularised the story in the United States, and her version of the story is the one which is most familiar to people today. So why is it surprising that her story has kind of won out?
It was made into a film, wasn't it?
I'll come to that.
Oh!
You look like you really want to say
yeah,
well,
yeah,
it.
Well,
it's because she never visited Scotland.
Yeah, she'd never visited Scotland. And she made up a lot of the story herself from her own imagination. But that's the story that's...
Did she follow it up with sort of one all about Gellert and Gellert's grave as well? You know, sort of famous dogs won't die sort of series.
So there was this English philanthropist, Lady Burdett Coutts, who chose to commemorate Bobby with the statue that you mentioned. So she commissioned a drinking fountain with an upper fountain for humans and a lower fountain for dogs, and Bobby's statue on the top. The idea was it would be a drinking fountain, but the local council closed down all the drinking fountains in about 1975 after a health scare. What is unusual about this particular monument, or can we call it a building? There's a clue here.
I know it's been a fringe venue in the past.
It's been a fringe venue?
Yeah, the Potter Trail registered it as a... because they would do their tours around Edinburgh in the fringe,
yeah.
But to be in the fringe guide, you have to be assigned a venue, so they chose that spot.
Oh, okay.
Which I know is not related to this, but...
No, it's not interesting anyway. It's actually Edinburgh's smallest listed building.
Mm. Oh, really?
Yeah. I think there's an alternative word for buildings, a monument possibly. What else? So because we're running out of time.
It's a tiny doghouse.
Sorry.
It's like a doghouse.
Ah, yes. Yeah. The venue, the doghouse. I can see things all connecting together here.
Smallest one in Scotland, is it? So my day job is looking after listed buildings and helping people restore them and things like that. So it's I should use that when I go back to work and take that with all along.
Yeah. So finally, why was the 2006 film The Adventures of Greyfriars Bobby controversial? And this goes back to the thing that we said at the start.
They made him a cat.
Oh, yes, that would have been controversial.
Well, that's political correctness gone mad.
Yes, yes.
Was it a female dog?
Well, the part of Bobby was given to a West Highland White Terrier. Now, this led to protests from the Skye Terrier Breed Club. So Christopher Figg, the producer, had to justify this decision. He said that a Westie was used because its white coat would stand out in the dark and because its eyes would not be hidden from the camera by a fringe.
So they actually recast Scarlett Johansson to play Greyfriars Bobby in the new version.
I quite like the idea that at the entrance to the kirkyard there was a sign which says no dogs allowed. But I checked this out and it doesn't exist. It's just a nice story.
What if the sign does exist, but he keeps seeing you coming up there?
Oh, yeah,
like, Richard's back. Quick, hide the sign. He's going to make a point on his podcast.
Unfortunately, our time is nearly up, so please just can we now thank the guests that you've seen today. So we've seen Paul Connolly, Luis Alcada and CJ Hooper. Thank you. And to thank the Edinburgh Festival Fringe and the Hill Street Theatre for hosting us today. The next show will be in its very venue tomorrow morning, the 9th of August at 10:45. Guests, would you just very quickly like to plug anything that you've got on the go, either in the Fringe or outside?
Yeah, sure. So I am a part of TBC Improv, as I mentioned earlier, and we have Absolute Improv running every day at 7:45 at the Space on the Mile, that's short form improv. And then I'm in Spontaneous Potter, which is every day at 6:30 at the Stand Newtown Theatre. And you can find me online at Paul Connolly Actor.
Thank you.
I run gigs in the Leafy over there, but I'm also doing a work in progress next Tuesday, 6:15 at Leet Depot on Leet Walk, as the name says. I decided to take a year off from the Fringe, got really bored, and just put the work in progress for next year.
I'm doing a show for which there are flyers there on the table. It's called What If History. It's improvised poetry based on alternative suggestions as suggested by you. So if you'd like to come and see me die on stage while trying to make up rhyming poems, then it's at 125 Brewdog on Lothian Road. The food's there is very nice as well if you'd like to have your lunch while watching the show.
So CJ is very clever. He's doing himself down here, so I know how good you are. So yeah. My final on-stay piece is from 8th of August 1974. In the wake of the Watergate scandal and while facing impeachment, Richard Nixon announced he was to step down as President of the United States, the first ever to do so. Here are some President Nixon quotes. Somehow, they seem timeless. Number one, solutions are not the answer. Number two, politics would be a hell of a good business if it weren't for the goddamn people. Number three, in a 1977 interview with David Frost, he said, when the president does it, that means it's not illegal. Number four, reflecting on the Watergate scandal in 1978, he said, I was not lying. I said things that later on seemed to be untrue. Number five, it is the responsibility of the media to look at the president with a microscope, but they go too far when they start using a proctoscope. And the final one, in his 1974 State of the Union address at the height of the Watergate scandal, he meant to talk about replacing the discredited present system, but instead said, I urge the Congress to join me in mounting a major new effort to replace the discredited president. And on that note, thank you for coming and goodbye.